nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right. Well, I was asked to first to introduce myself. I'm Vlad Shalaev. I was born in Russia. I was born in true Russia, because actually it's Siberia. So like in this country, if someone comes from New York City, you don't say he's American, you say he's New Yorker. So I'm from Siberia, eastern part of Siberia, and I have kind of cosmopolitan background. I worked in many countries. My PhD is in physics, actually, in mathematics, but I worked in different areas and in different countries. And I'm very happy to be now with electrical and computer engineering, which is probably the best place for people like myself with training like I have to work in. Well, it's always a problem what to start from. And when I was thinking what I should begin with, I recalled the story when I was given a talk somewhere, I don't remember where, and I was a little bit nervous. My wife, who is actually a very good Argentinian tango dancer, well, she would say, don't worry, there are two rules to have successful performance. Number one, you should keep connection to the floor, and you should embrace a partner, in this case, the audience, I guess. So I'll try to follow to these two important things in this presentation, and let's see how it works. I'd like also to thank the NCN for this opportunity to share the excitement we have working in this new emerging area of nanophotonics, which is kind of became like a holy grail for physics and technology nowadays. And let me start with basically explaining the title, why I have this title for my presentation, plasmonic nanophotonics. Well, first of all, why photonics? Because a photon is the ultimate messenger. It has the largest possible speed, which is the speed of light. And with photons, you package information into a signal of zero mass. So this is the ultimate messenger to the nanoworld and from the nanoworld. Why it should be nano? Why I use this word nano? Well, the reason number one, because we would like to have our elements based on which we built our devices as small as possible, to have them on nanoscale. Then you can package into a particular device much more elements and therefore make your devices more powerful. There is another reason for nano, as one of my friends pointed out. Nano is a Latin word for funding. So this is a good area to get some extra money and to do this, to have fun for at the expense of the government. And finally, why I put this word plasmonic? That could be a puzzle for some of you. The reason is that the wavelengths of light in the visible range is half a micron, which is a huge scale when you compare it to nanostructures. Let's say if you have a nanostructure which is 10 nanometer in size only, whereas the wavelength is half a micron, you can see right away there is a huge mismatch in sizes. Light basically doesn't see such small things as nanostructures, therefore it doesn't couple to nanostructures effectively. And plasmons, which basically represent collective oscillations of electrons in metals, do this miracle. They allow focus light down to nanoscale. They can concentrate electromagnetic energy of light in the nanoscale and efficiently couple to light. So they work like nanoantennas by coupling nanostructures to light. Therefore, they really, really make a difference for the whole field. I could state as a theorem, if you want to do true nanophotonics, you basically cannot do it unless you bring metals into the game, which through these plasmon excitations can efficiently couple such big light in the sense of the wavelengths down to nanostructure. So it is actually a key player in the game called nanophotonics. And so here's the things I'd like to discuss with you. Well, I will introduce these plasmon excitations, and there are two versions of them. One is so-called surface plasmon polariton, which have waves, propagating waves of plasmon excitations. There are also so-called localized surface plasmons, which are concentrated in all three dimensions. I discussed with you sensing, which is probably the most spectacular application of plasmonic nanostructures nowadays. It's something which is already broadly used. And finally, I'm happy to discuss with you something which completely takes breath away from many people because it's so exciting. It has to do with negative refractive index. It's one of the probably most spectacular and exciting developments recent days in the area of optics. And finally, before I proceed, let me acknowledge support from these funding agencies. As again, another friend of mine once said, vision without funding is hallucination. So I'm really happy to have this support from these agencies and to do research which I'm about to discuss with you. Well, this is a plot which shows how the speed with which we process information evolved with time. And it started from telegraph, like roughly 1 bit of information per second. And it evolved to CMOS electronics. It's the way actually we process information, nearly all information through this CMOS electronics. And it's great, and there is still a pretty long way to go here. And Mark Landstrom, he's not here, but I'm not sure he will watch this videotape. I hope he won't be angry with me for saying this. It's great, CMOS electronics, but it's running out of steam. So simply because there are some fundamental problems, such as RC delay. So we should think of new generation of devices based on other approaches. And that could be photonics. As I already mentioned, the ultimate speed, therefore you can process information at the largest possible rate in this case. And there are already demonstrated lots of wonderful photonic devices which actually can operate at the speed as high as 1 terahertz. However, there is a fundamental problem which I already mentioned. Any device which kind of works, couples to light, has to be microphotonic device. It has to have the size of features on a micron scale to match the size of the wavelengths. But that's not good enough for us. It's too big, too bulky. We want to have our devices much smaller. We want to have nanoscale devices. And that's, again, why we need these plasmonics, because they are like these tiny nano antennas. They are efficient couplers across nano-micro interface. They bring micron-scale light down to nanostructures and efficiently couple to them. Well, having said so many good things about plasmons, it's time to introduce them. Basically, well, what makes metals different from other materials, electrons are free to move there. And if I take a metal-dielectric interface, then a surface plasmon wave can propagate. And that wave is nothing but just electron gas density wave. If you have some kind of increased density of electrons in some area, it's clear that charge density would propagate along the interface between metal and dielectric. So this is a surface wave which exponentially decays into both materials, into dielectric and metal, and propagates along the interface. The beautiful thing about the surface plasmon polaritons, if you do a little bit algebra, look at the Maxwell's equation and boundary conditions, then you would end up with this expression which expresses the momentum of surface plasmon polariton or the wave vector which characterizes propagation of these surface waves as a function of the basic material parameters such as epsilon m, which is dielectric permittivity of metal. It's a basic characteristic of metal. And epsilon d, which is the dielectric characteristic of the dielectric part. What makes metals different from other materials, epsilon m is negative. That's why the male part of this audience, when you're shaving, you can see your face because it's reflection. Metals expel light from themselves. They act in such a way, electrons distributed in such a way that they compensate the external field and expel it. So epsilon in metals is negative. And since it's negative, I can always arrange such a situation when this guy almost compensates this one. It's negative in sign, it's almost has almost the same magnitude but different in sign, so that I would get here a very small number so that wave vector becomes very large. What it means now, if I plot the frequency of my surface plasmon waves as a function of the wave vector, that there are very large wave vectors k. But large wave vector k means that the wavelength is extremely small. And here we have absolutely unique situation that we are dealing with optical frequencies, because all these excitations are excited by light. They have the frequency of the driving force, which is light. It's the optical frequency. However, the wavelength can be very small. It can be on the nanoscale. So these are unique waves which have optical frequencies and X-ray wavelengths. That's what surface plasmon polaritons are about. It's almost like unthinkable for any other waves. So when you convert energy of your light into surface plasmon polaritons, you keep the frequency. You work at the same optical frequencies, but the wavelength shrinks down to nanoscale. So that now the wavelengths of surface plasmon polariton can match the size of a nanostructure. It can be as small as 10 nanometers, and therefore it can very efficiently couple to nanostructure. And that's the idea. That's a paradigm standing behind all this approach. You see, light couples to metallic nanostructure, it excites plasmon polariton, and that plasmon polariton has such small wavelength that it efficiently couples to other nanostructures. Now you can manipulate the surface plasmon polariton. You can create these photonic chips. You can do integrated circuits with surface plasmon polaritons. That's the beauty. That's actually the solution, how you can make true nanophotonics with optical frequencies. One could argue, wait a minute, metals are lossy. Well, and they are, actually. However, there are special type of excitations which are surprisingly have extremely small losses. And those are called long-range surface plasmon polaritons. In fact, people studied them long ago. Somehow it was forgotten. And when people realized that surface plasmon polaritons are such major players in nanophotonics, they rediscover, actually, these long-range surface plasmon polaritons. What are those about? If you take a metal film, thick film, on a dielectric, placed on a dielectric, so there are actually two surface plasmon waves, one at the metal-air interface, another, let's say, metal-glass interface, and they do not couple. They propagate independent of each other. If you make it thinner, the two waves start couple each other, and if it's extremely thin, there is a special mode which has the electrical field along the propagation in this asymmetrical form, so that actually it goes through zero in the middle of the film. You can see that this electrical field along the propagation actually goes from positive to negative. That's, on average, it's like zero. And I guess by intuition, you could agree with me that when you make it thinner and thinner film, then this mode would actually propagate with very little losses. And that indeed turns out to be the case. If you plot the propagation as a function of thickness of this film, you can see that for very thin films on the scale of 10 nanometers, which is close to the so-called skin depths, it's the thickness of metal through which light can penetrate, then propagation can be extremely low, so that this surface plasmon waves propagate over distance close to 1 centimeter. Think of this. We are developing devices which are as small as a nanometer, and your waves propagate over distance as large as 1 centimeter. So that's ideal. It's almost like no losses. So although losses is a problem, but it's a manageable problem. And so people already demonstrated this wonderful long-range surface plasmon polariton stripe guide, like the one shown here. And the losses which we experimentally measured are on the scale of 5 dB per centimeter, and the coupling loss is only 0.5 dB. And that's actually extremely important. If you want to couple light coming from the external field, from the external world, all the information actually, or most of the information, at least in the near future, going to go through fibers, because this is the fastest way to send information. And if you want to send information over seas or larger distances, so you basically want to use something like optical wave of sending information. But then you want to couple it to nanophotonic chip. How to do it? So you need to couple fibers to your nanostructures. And that's the way. See, you could think of this box like a fiber and this nanoscale stripe waveguide as the structure which efficiently couples it to your integrated circuit, photonic circuit. The whole goal, everything what I'm talking about, we would like to learn to manipulate photons in the same fashion as we manipulate electrons in electronic circuits. We would like to develop photonic integrated circuits which would do all the functions of electronic circuits but would be faster because photons are faster than electrons. They don't have masses, after all. So there is huge progress in this area. People couple light from fibers to these photonic chips, as is schematically shown here. There are all these passive integrated surface plasmon polariton elements, such as bands, splitters, waveguides. There are also active elements. How you can make active elements, actually? Like, for example, this one. It's called Mach-Zehnder interference modulator. In this case, you have two arms along which you send your plasmon waves. And you put here two electrodes. If you don't apply the voltage, then obviously, since these two arms are identical, the surface plasmon polaritons meet each other here and they combine. You have just like a sum of the two waves. However, if you apply the voltage here, and let's say all the structure is placed to some kind of nonlinear polymer, then what you do in this case, you heat this piece of wire, and since you heat it, you change slightly the temperature, and because of that, you slightly change the refractive index of the host material, which is a polymer in this case. But when you change the refractive index, it means that you change the phase of surface plasmon wave propagating through this arm. And you can choose it so that at this point, negative interference occurs, destructive interference, so that the two waves completely balance each other, and you have zero signal here. You see, by applying voltage, you can make the signal going through, or you can switch it off by simply applying the voltage. It's a wonderful way of doing active plasmonics. You can couple plasmons from one wire to another one, again, without these two electrodes, when you don't apply voltage. So what plasmon wave from this arm couples to this one. However, if you apply the voltage, you change the refractive index again, and the speed of these plasmon waves becomes different in the two arms. They kind of mismatch each other. Therefore, the coupling is not efficient anymore, and no wave, no signal goes to this arm. So you can play all these tricks. You can make logics, yes and no, as the things which you need in a computer. You can completely mimic electronic circuits, but in this case, you work at optical frequencies. It means that you can process information much faster, and all your devices can be on the nanoscale. That's the holy grail for nanophotonics. That's what you want eventually to accomplish. There is another alternative way to do nanophotonics, and this is kind of hybrid approach. In this case, you combine photonic crystals, which is a very, very exciting area now in physics and nanotechnology and electrical engineering. Let me first say a few words about these photonic crystals. They're basically periodical structures made of dielectric. And since it's dielectric, there are no losses. That's a wonderful thing. And because of the periodicity, if you make a channel like the one shown in otherwise periodical structure, then what happens, because of the multiple scattering and Bragg reflection, the light actually remains confined in this channel and doesn't go away. That's the idea behind these so-called photonic wires based on photonic crystals. And losses in these photonic wires or photonic band gap structures are extremely low. So what you could do in this case, you could guide light through these photonic crystal waveguides, but provide the functionality with metal structures. Then you can actually envision this type of microphotonic chip as the one which is shown here. When you bring information through a fiber to a chip, you couple it to your photonic chip, then you multiplex a signal and send wavelengths, send information in different wavelengths into different channels. Then you switch it with optical cross connect, and the whole operation is controlled by on-chip photodetector. What metals in this case do, they provide the functionality, actually nanoscale functionality. Like, for example, for efficient coupling of information coming through your optical fiber to a chip, you use this stripe waveguide made of metal, nanoscale metal. You can make delay lines by placing metal nanostructures inside of your photonic wires. Since they are resonant structures, they decrease the speed with which wave propagates, and you can make delay lines, which of course are essential for manipulating light in photonic structures. And you can make this photodetector by placing your bow tie like nano antenna inside of a cavity. And bow tie nano antennas can concentrate electromagnetic energy on extremely small scales down to 5 nanometers, creating extremely high local fields and therefore dramatically increasing sensitivity. So this hybrid approach, the previous one was based entirely on metal structures. So we basically, we're manipulating light with only metallic structures. In this case, you have both dielectric structures,
photonic crystals, extremely low structures, and metal structures. And by combining them, you can also develop these nanophotonic shapes. I should say, although I'm speaking of this, it's still not like applications of tomorrow. We still have several years ahead of us to develop these true microphotonic chips. This is at the boundary between fundamental science and engineering. It's not yet just pure engineering. There's lots of things, fundamental problems to resolve. However, since it's so important, information is nearly everything, I'm absolutely sure that this is the future. This is the question only time and our hard work when we will have these nanophotonic chips available. All right, I was speaking so far about propagating plasmon excitations. There is also localized counterpart of this plasmon, surface plasmon, which is called localized surface plasmons. In this case, energy is confined in all three directions. And actually, it's quite easy to envision this type of surface plasmon excitation. Let's take a, gold nanoparticle, like 10 nanometer in size gold ball. And if you displace electrons from the equilibrium, then obviously what you have, you would have excess negative charge on one side and positive charge on the other side. There would be restoring force, which would make electrons, which are free to move, to bounce up and down. It's like if you take a glass and shake it slightly, glass with the water, and shake, let's take wine, my water, and shake it slightly, the wine would just bounce from one side to another one. That's exactly pretty close similarity. From the mathematical point of view, it's nearly the same as oscillation of these electrons in a metal nanoparticle. And the beauty of this, if you do a little bit mathematics, you can show that these plasmon excitations in the metal nanoparticle in one-to-one correspondence with conventional LC circuit. And it also can be treated as actually non-antenna, like Hertz antenna to be specific, but operating at optical frequencies and on nanoscale. Antennas are nearly everything in our technology. Antennas are extremely important. All our TV sets, radio sets, it's all about antennas. It's about efficient coupling electromagnetic radiation to your devices. This is the optical analog of those devices. This is nanoantenna, which couples to optical frequencies. Therefore, the importance of these nanoantennas, at least as big as nanoantennas operating in radio for radio waves and microwaves. And there are all type of different ways to excite these localized plasmons. One of them is based on the so-called nanoshells. In this case, you have a dielectric core, again, like 10 nanometer in size, let's say glass or something like that, and you coat it with metal. And depending on the thickness of this metal coating, the position of the resonance, or in other words, the frequency at which your nanoantenna resonates, would shift. The thinner the coating, the stronger the shift toward the longer wavelength. And this approach, which is used by Naomi Hala's research group at Rice University. Another very exciting approach is used by Van Dyne from the Northwestern University. He's using the so-called nanosphere lithography, which is a very easy way to fabricate this type of nanopyramids made of gold, and they also act as very nice nanoantennas. And as I already mentioned, perhaps one of the best way to concentrate energy, light energy on the nanoscale, is to use these bowtie antennas, like the one shown here. In this case, actually, the power of this concentrated light could be 5 to 6 orders of magnitude greater than the power of the incident light, simply because this antenna accumulates energy in the course of time and create local field intensity much greater, orders of magnitude greater than the intensity in incident light. So they are not just antennas, they are extremely efficient optical nanoantennas. Well, we speak of all this surface plasma, it's all very exciting. However, it looks like many, many things which we consider new. We have this saying in Russia. I'm not sure whether there is something similar in this country. New is often well forgotten old. Well, this surface plasmon things, it's one of the hottest area of physics and nanotechnology nowadays. However, if you look at the history, people did lots of related stuff. Actually, surprisingly, very closely related stuff, which we call now nanoplasmonics. Well, let me start from this piece of work done by great physicist Robert Wood. He wrote in his paper something about the NMLO's diffraction from a grating. And now it's absolutely clear that that was related to surface plasmon polaritons, these propagating surface plasmons. Although he didn't call them this way, but actually it was about surface plasmon polaritons. I also would like to draw your attention to one more aspect of this. Look at the style which Robert Wood, one of the greatest ever physicists living, used. Look how passionately he writes about this. Look, remarkable case. I have been examining a most remarkable grating to a degree almost incomprehensible, and compare it with dry, emotion-free, detached style, which lots of us use nowadays, writing papers. I think I miss this, because that was his life, and he wouldn't hide all his emotions, all his passion about his discoveries. He would put it in his paper. I was truly amazed to read such a wonderful way of expressing your results. Well, that was about propagating surface plasmon. How about localized surface plasmon? In this case, there is even more spectacular way to show that that was known for decades, actually for centuries. Those of you who were lucky to spend some time in Europe, you obviously would see these absolutely beautiful stained glasses in mid-century churches. But all these beautiful colors are entirely due to these metal nanoparticles. Of course, the ancient masters never would call it nanoplasmonics or nanostructures. They simply created these beautiful structures. Look at these spectacular colors. And so they did it without using these fancy words. Of course, there was not at the time National Science Foundation. They didn't have to actually use these fancy words to make these beautiful things. A little bit more of these examples. I was astonished to learn myself that actually the first one who created these metal nanostructures was absolutely one of the most genius physicists or chemists, whatever, scientists in general, Michael Faraday. He was the one who proposed the way to make these colloidal nanoparticles. That was his invention. And the same Michael Faraday who played absolutely critical role in developing this electromagnetic theory. So that I was astonished to learn this. As often happens in history, the one who got Nobel Prize for colloidal particles was not Michael Faraday, it was Richard Zsigmondy, a little bit later, but there was a Nobel Prize for these colloidal metal nanoparticles. And here I'm showing these beautiful vase. Those of you who have a chance to go to the famous London Museum, that's where it's located. It's famous Rome vase. And look how beautiful colors are. And depending where you put the source of light inside of the vase so that you see at the vase in transmission, it has red color. And if you put the source of your light outside, it has this beautiful green color. Well, and of course, Gustav Mie. Gustav Mie was a beautiful theorist who, in the beginning of the 20th century, created a theory how these spherical nanoparticles interact with light. And I decided to use this beautiful slide, this survey which done my friend Carsten Sonicsen. And what he did here, actually, he studied, well, how many citations for these three key people in the area of colloidal science happened through this many decades. Well, as for Faraday, maybe there are not that many citations, but that's clear why, because all this electromagnetic theory written now by modern authors, everybody knows Michael Faraday. Nobody would try to question his absolutely great contribution to science. Zsigmondy is nearly forgotten, whereas Mie, of course, the citation index is great, and the conclusion could be, even the Nobel Prize winner might be forgotten. Or another possible conclusion, you might think what you want to become in the future, theorist or experimentalist. Don't take it seriously, though. Well, I mentioned that sensing is one of the most spectacular applications of these metallic nanostructures. And that's something that people use right now. Because with these metal nanostructures, which concentrate energy, create extremely high local field, you can sense even individual single molecules. That's an absolutely wonderful devices which people use right now. Well, sensor based on surface plasmon polariton. Well, I have to say a few words that in the heart of sensing, there is this detection of binding between antibody and antigen. I don't want to go into detail about this, but just take my word that if you want to make a sensor, like biomedical sensor, to detect binding between antibody and antigen is absolutely critical, because this is the way to detect disease. This is the way to make analysis of your biomedical condition. This is the way to develop drugs. It's extremely important. So how this sensor works? So it's basically a prism. You send the light here, and because of total internal reflection, it reflects here. And you make a channel here through which you send the flow of antibodies, which is shown here with these Ys. And when they bind antigens, this is antigen and antibody, then they form these bound structures. And they think about this, that when this binding occurs, you basically slightly change the host for the surface plasmon polariton which propagates along this interface. Very slightly, because we're speaking only of a monolayer of antibody and antigen. But this very tiny change in the dielectric constant of this surrounding material, which is in this case of these biomolecules, results in slight change of this epsilon D. And because of that, you had slightly shifted the position of the resonance. You see, you edit a little bit molecules here, a monolayer, and you change the constant which characterizes the host material, the dielectric in this case, in the position of resonance shift from position 1 to position 2. And this is an unbelievably sensitive device, which actually people use now in the labs. Based on propagating surface plasmons, there is a counterpart of that, which is based on localized surface plasmons. And two key names in this area, it's Van Dyne, the same Van Dyne, Richard Van Dyne from Northwestern, and Jochen Feldmann from Munich University, from University of Munich. So what they suggested is you take a metal nanoparticle, such as gold nanoparticle, when you inactivate it with antibodies, as it's shown here. Okay, when the binding with antigens occurs, so then you slightly add a little bit dielectric, something into dielectric constant here. And because of that, there is a small shift in the position of surface plasmon resonance. So this shift is indicator that the binding occurred. So this is, again, it's extremely sensitive to the extent that you can feel just one monolayer of this antibody and antigens. The only problem with these two approaches, they both actually don't provide information about these molecules, about so-called analyte molecules. They just say that something changed in the environment and therefore the position of resonance changed. The absolutely ideal way to do sensing would be it's to use so-called Raman scattering. What is Raman scattering? So you send the light at some optical frequencies, and if you have molecules, they all vibrate. They have certain vibrational frequencies. When light interacts with these molecules, it experiences slight shift in frequency, and the shift, the magnitude of that shift is exactly equal to the frequency of these vibrations. That's called Raman scattering. And it turns out that Raman scattering is the best fingerprint of molecules. By looking at Raman spectra, you can absolutely precisely say what kind of molecules you're dealing with. Not only that, you could say what conformational state of that molecule, whether it's phosphorylating or non-phosphorylated. And phosphorylation is usually a sign of developing disease. So this is the best fingerprint of biological molecules. However, the cross-section for Raman scattering is extremely small. It's a very, very low sensitivity method. What to do? So what people suggested to use so-called surface-enhanced Raman scattering by basically adding these metal nanostructures, these metal nanoantennas, to dramatically increase local fields, to accumulate light energy. And by doing that, you can increase by many orders of magnitude sensitivity of Raman signal, actually by up to 10 orders of magnitude. 10 billion times Raman can be increased by using surface-enhanced Raman scattering, by using these metal nanoantennas. And there are different approaches, and it would be subject of yet another presentation. Let me just mention one approach which we use in this lab, and I have to mention a critical role which Dr. Drachev played in these developments, and a number of my students, such as Mark Thorsen, who actually fabricate these type of structures. We call them adaptive silver films. Why we call them so, and why it's important to use them for sensing. The best sensing would occur if you place your molecule between metal nanoparticles. And exactly between metal nanoparticles, you have extremely high local fields. The reason it occurs this way because these metal pieces work as inductive elements. They have negative epsilon, remember, and that works like inductive element, but at optical frequencies. And a gap in between, like a capacitance, but again at optical frequencies. And all the field is concentrated here and can be orders of magnitude greater than the applied field. If you manage to place molecules here, then the increase in Raman signal would be absolutely dramatic. Well, one could say, hey, let's fabricate, use e-beam lithography or something like ion focus beam lithography and make this type of antennas which would have the right gap. But you see, all molecules are so different in sizes. I mean, you cannot really make universal sensor for different type of biological molecules. So what we decided to use as approach is basically to let molecule restructure these non-antennas in such a way that molecules themselves decide, choose the structure, and optimize surface-enhanced Raman scattering. Let me illustrate this idea. So first, you make these metal nanoparticles by using just thermal evaporation with a beam on an insulator like glass. And then you put your molecules, proteins, which we study. And these protein molecules work like glue. They kind of bring these particles together. They glue them. It's like nano-glue. And they take this position exactly in the gaps. And the size of these gaps naturally is roughly equal to the size of the molecules because molecules bring particles together. So they sit in the right position and they choose the size of the gap, exactly the one which is optimal for surface-enhanced Raman scattering. So you have here soft adsorption in the sense that molecules are not denatured. They preserve their biological functionality. And in parallel, they optimize surface-enhanced Raman scattering. That's really a wonderful development, which we almost accidentally found out. What you see here is a field emission electron microscope before placing proteins. And after, you can see this formation of small clusters, these particles which are glued with proteins. And just to illustrate that it really works for important application, I show only one, although we did lots of studies in this area. But that has to do with diabetes. Only in this country there are 17 million people suffering of this disease. It's a very dangerous disease. And we know that we treat it with insulin. Unfortunately, insulin works extremely slow. It takes several hours when it starts working in your body. What Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company did, they developed a variant of insulin. Normally insulin consists of this 51 amino acid. It turns out if you switch only two amino acids, lysine and proline, in their position, these two, okay, then insulin, this variant of insulin, works several times faster. To be specific, four or five times faster. Instead of the matter of hours, it works on the scale of minutes. That's unbelievable. But how can you distinguish these two proteins, these two insulins? They have the same mass, the same chemical formula, and the only change is this tiny change in the position to neighbor amino acids. In which these adaptive silver films, and using surface-enhanced Raman scattering, we readily and reproducibly could distinguish these two different biologically important molecules. Blue shows here the traditional insulin, and red shows source spectra for this variant developed by Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company. And this is actually required by FDA to distinguish these two insulin to sell it. So this is just example how this, using this metal nanostructures, you can develop this wonderful sensor. And just to sum up this part, I'd like to say that there are well-established techniques, so-called surface plasmon resonance technique for sensing, based on propagating surface plasmon or localized surface plasmons, but also there are new emerging sensors which provide direct information about what you actually sense. Based on Raman scattering, which is, I mentioned, actually as the best fingerprint, and so what we develop in our lab, we call them adaptive silver films because they're capable restructure themselves on nanoscale to optimize surface-enhanced Raman scattering. All right, there's lots of future here, but I'd like to discuss with you one more, and to my taste, most exciting development in the area related to nanophotonics, which has to do with negative refraction. It doesn't happen that often in science when people have to reconsider the very basics, the very fundamentals of that science. And nobody would argue with me that refractive index is one of the most fundamental characteristics of light. It characterizes momentum of photons. So it's very, very fundamental. And the idea that refractive index could be negative, actually sounded, would sound to me 5 years ago as kind of ridiculous. But that's actually what people realized recently and started to develop devices based on absolutely this fantastic phenomenon, which people call now negative refractive index. So let me explain why it's important and what is this about. Well, if you look at the refraction, when light rays are incident at the interface between two media, let's say air and water, for example, what happens is that at the interface, a beam experiences this refraction. And this described by very old law, which is, I mean, existing for many, many decades, Snell's law. And so that tells you at which angle, with respect to the normal, the beam would propagate after refraction. However, if the refractive index is negative, it means that the wave vector changes its sign because the wave vector is proportional to the refractive index. In other words, the now wave vector should look in opposite direction. However, the interface, the component of the wave vector along the interface has to be preserved because of the momentum conservation. And that requires, if you change the direction of k and you have to preserve the component, the parallel component, the only way to do it is for a beam to go in this direction. You see, it kind of goes in the wrong direction. After refraction, instead of going the normal way, it goes this way. But even more surprising thing, that the energy goes this way, outward with respect to the interface, whereas the wave vector goes in the opposite way. The phase and the energy propagate in opposite directions. It's, of course, it's a very, very counterintuitive, but that's true. And to show again how important this notion of refractive index, let me show you this diagram, which kind of shows where these different materials could be placed in terms of their basic parameters. So if you look at the way we describe light, so it's just like we can always decompose it into plane waves, and the basic characteristic, as I said, the wave vector, which is omega over c times the refractive index. And the refractive index is simply the square root of the product of these two parameters, epsilon and mu, dielectric permittivity and magnetic permeability, where epsilon describes the response to the electrical component of light, and mu describes the response of your material to the magnetic component. Normally, they're both positive. So that's where most of the world exists. So epsilon mu positive, and therefore square root is just real number, and light propagates nicely through media like glass, air, water, you name it. However, if one of the two becomes negative, then the product of these two becomes negative too. It means that the square root of negative number becomes imaginary, purely imaginary. In other words, wave does not propagate through such a material. Such material becomes opaque. And one of these materials we do know, it's actually metals. In metals, epsilon is negative, as I told you. So, but mu is positive normally. Therefore, what you have, light does not penetrate into metal. Metal is opaque for light. That's a well-known example. However, imagine now that both epsilon and mu negative, both of them negative, then the product becomes real number. And again, square root of a positive number, well, it's a real number, so light can propagate through such a medium again. So if you kind of create a material where both epsilon and mu negative, then surprisingly, light can go through. But it's not the same as you would have in the case with both epsilon and mu positive. It's now transparent, but it's different. And I just illustrated it. For example, Snell's law works in a different way. The Doppler effect is different. Like half of conventional optical phenomena start looking in a very different way if the refractive index becomes negative. To even further emphasize the importance of this phenomenon, let's look at the way we see objects, how we image them. It's a well-known criterion that actually you cannot, with conventional optics, to resolve details which are in size smaller than the wavelengths. Those components are simply exponentially decay. It's well known that if the wave vector is larger than the wave vector of this transverse Fourier decomposition, if it's larger than omega over c, then that component exponentially decays. It's evanescent. And therefore, if you have an object which has fine detail, let's say the grating period d, if it's smaller than the wavelengths, then you cannot see that details. They basically will be lost because the information, those Fourier components which describe this periodicity with such fine period would have wave vector larger than omega over c, and therefore it would be exponentially decayed. You cannot see it. You get blurred image. So it's in year 2000, Sir John Pendry from the Imperial College wrote absolutely revolutionary paper in Physical Review Letters. And he would say, if you make a lens out of material with refractive index equal minus 1, then in principle, you can image objects with unlimited resolution. You can beat the diffraction limit. That, of course, was so against the expectation that immediately there were several comments saying that it's ridiculous, it cannot be true, and they would explain why it cannot be true. People now believe, in fact, it is true. In principle, it is possible to image with resolution much better than the wavelengths in the far zone, I want to emphasize here. However, it's very hard to realize in practice because of material limitation. That's what we and other groups in the world are working now very hard on. Can we really make it work in reality? But at least in theory, it is possible. That was called perfect lens because, in principle, such lens could provide resolution which is not limited by the wavelengths. And to give you a little bit more insight, let's say again, we have a grating, okay, with a period much smaller than the wavelengths. You can describe it in terms of this Fourier decomposition. And you can see if the size of this grating much smaller than the wavelength, then Q, the wave vector, would be larger than omega over C. It would be exponentially decayed. You cannot see it. Now, if you look at the total phase shift, which is acquired in the air, and the lens which has refractive index equal minus 1, with epsilon equal minus 1 and mu equal minus 1, then the phase which is acquired in the air is exactly equal in magnitude and opposite in sign to the phase acquired in the metal. These two phases completely balance each other. You could think of this as like this negative material annihilates the space. There is positive part of the space and negative part of the space, and they annihilate each other so that you have here the situation as light didn't propagate at all. Therefore, you have perfect reconstruction because negative world annihilates the positive world. Negative N annihilates the positive N. That's, of course, a very exciting possibility. And there is one easy part of that, relatively easy. It turns out if you look at the near zone, if you don't want to have this imaging beyond the diffraction limit in the far zone but want to do it in the near zone only, then in this case, electrical and magnetic components are decoupled from each other. And the only requirement to have this sub-wavelength resolution remains in this case is just epsilon should be negative, the electric permittivity, whereas mu can be equal 1. And in this case, that idea was also proposed by John Pendry. And so he basically showed this with these simulations first, that if you have two slabs which are located at the distance much smaller than the wavelengths, then without a silver slab, you cannot resolve them. If you put here a silver slab in between, then you can resolve the two slabs. So, but in this case, the object is very close to your lens, at the distance smaller than the wavelengths. I want to emphasize that it's not the same as near-field scanning optical microscopy, because in this case, you get the whole image right away, not pixel by pixel as you do with a type of near-field optical microscope. And this idea has been already realized by the Berkeley group, led by Professor Zhang. So published this year in Science, they demonstrated, they imaged this word nana, actually, and showed that you can get this sub-wavelength resolution in the near zone, though. So it's not true perfect lens, because mu in this case not relevant. To make it true negative lens, it's a little bit bigger challenge. Actually, it's much bigger challenge. So in this case, you have both. You need both epsilon and mu to become negative. And the problem is, in the microwave range, people pretty have accomplished it already and demonstrated, because in microwave wave range, you can actually fabricate these materials, which are often called metamaterials, because they do not exist in nature. People fabricate them. So, and they would fabricate materials which have negative mu and negative epsilon, and they demonstrated that. The goal which we pursue in my lab, we're trying to create these materials for the optical range, where applications would be particularly spectacular. However, it's a much bigger challenge. Let me explain why. Because at high frequencies, there are no materials which would have any magnetism. It's a well-known fact that magnetism goes away with high frequencies. There are no, if you look at the standard textbook, like Landau's textbook, it's written, no magnetism at high frequencies. Well, it turns out it's not exactly true. Although there are no materials which do show magnetism at optical frequencies, you can create such metamaterials which would mimic behavior the same as you would have with magnetism. And that's actually what we are trying to do. Let me explain the idea. First of all, I should say that there is a huge competition in this area now. Several groups working all over the world trying to first demonstrate this negative refractive index material in the optical range, because everybody realizes how it's important and revolutionary, how huge impact could be on various areas of optical technology. First, people tried to do to show this magnetism at optical frequencies, which, as I said, a huge challenge. There are several groups listed here. What they did first, they basically used the same structures which already demonstrated magnetism at microwave range, but made them smaller and smaller on nanoscale. Makes sense. I mean, there are some so-called split ring resonator structures which are proven to show magnetism. Just make them smaller, and therefore the frequency at which they resonate would become smaller too. And it all happened very recently. During last and this year, negative magnetism was demonstrated in various type of structures, but not negative refractive index, because this is only one of two ingredients. You need to have negative both epsilon and mu. So we choose a different approach, not to mimic what people did in the microwave range. And that approach is based on our original paper, which we published with Andrew Sarachev in year 2002. And that's actually about these two metal nanorods. So we show that if you have a layer of two metal nanorods, as is shown in this picture, so then that medium can act as a material with negative refractive index. Let me explain why. Well, since you have this, let's say, gold rods, obviously they would provide negative epsilon. Negative epsilon is not a challenge for the optical range. As I said, that metals have negative epsilon. Why would this structure show negative magnetism? That's actually not that hard to understand. Since my rods are oriented like this, and all located in the layer, they're like twin rods, they're parallel, and aligned with each other, and light is incident normal to the layer which has these parallel nanorods. So then the electrical component is, we assume, polarized along the rods, and the magnetic is perpendicular to the pairs, penetrating through them, like it's shown here. Then what would happen, because of the same Faraday, whom I mentioned already in my talk, the magnetic field oscillates, varies in time, and because of that, it should create the current, the loop current in such a medium. You could say, wait a minute, what kind of current you're talking about? Because your loop is disconnected. You have here two metal wires, but you have gaps here. But that's exactly what I need, actually, because at high frequencies, yes, I do have this ohmic current inside of the wires, but at high frequencies in the optical range, the displacement polarization current is as large as the conventional conduction current. Therefore, what happened, these metal wires work as inductive elements, whereas these gaps work as the capacitive elements. So altogether, it's like resonant LC circuit at the optical frequencies. So therefore, I do have actually a closed current going through my system, where here it's supported by capacitance, here it's supported by inductance. And the resonant frequency of my circuit is in the optical frequency range, which is beautiful. Then since I have a circle current, I have a magnetic moment. And above the resonance, that magnetic moment should be negative. And ironically, in the same textbook, Landau's textbook, which claims that there is no magnetism at high frequencies, we used the equations from the same textbook analytically show that actually for this particular system, mu does become negative. The next step was to prove it experimentally. Now I'm telling you a story which is like a few months old. It's all developing. It's what we are doing right now in my lab. So we fabricated this parallel nanorods, that like it's shown schematically here. Again, that shows the way the current goes. So this is a picture which shows the object which we fabricated using e-beam lithography. And you see the upper rod actually is smaller in size, therefore you can see it along with the bottom nanorod. And this is a beautiful array of these nanorods. This is AFM image of these gold nanorods. Well, the question is how to measure, how to prove that we are dealing with negative refractive index. Of course, we should look at the phases, because phases, if it was directly related to the refractive index. If refractive index is negative, then phase becomes negative. You cannot measure directly the phase, but you can measure phase with respect to some reference, with respect to some other beam which does not go through your material. And then if your phase smaller than a certain number, then you can claim that the refractive index becomes negative. Let me just quickly show this interference polarimeter, which Dr. Drachev in my lab developed, who is one of the world's best experts in this area. This is a beautiful experimental setup which allows to measure phases for light polarized along the rods when you have refractive index negative and perpendicular to the rods when it's positive. And it would require to go into details. Let me skip it. And here are the results. You can see that we measure here phase for both polarization parallel to the rods and perpendicular to the rods, and phase with respect to the reference, which is a beam not going through our sample. And you can see that the phase can be positive, which indicates that the refractive index is positive, and it goes to the negative range, indicating the fact that the refractive index can become negative, and it has this beautiful resonant dependence. So the bottom line is, when we use equations and retrieve the refractive index just using our experimental data, we obtain what we believe for the first time, the negative refractive index at the telecommunication wavelengths at 1.5 micron. Negative refractive index minus 0.3. We're absolutely positive that the refractive index is negative. The unfortunate problem is that we still have very large imaginary part. Losses in our material are pretty high. We are not ready to make a device out of this. But this is the first demonstration negative refractive index in the optical edge. We are very, very excited about possibilities, opportunities which are open here. We are sure we have good ideas how to solve the problem of losses, and we hope to make devices out of this in the near future. And Alex Kilyshev, who is sitting here, actually come up with new beautiful designs how to make effects much stronger by replacing these rods with stripes, metal stripes. In this case, you can have very strong magnetic field which looks in opposite direction with the incident magnetic field, indicating very strong negative magnetism. And here you can see his simulation that the refractive index for these structures he predicts to be close to minus 2. Very, very strong effect, which was unthinkable only a few years ago. All right, so let me summarize this part of my presentation. We believe this negative index materials, which possess negative refraction, is an absolutely exciting area of physics nanotechnology with lots of interesting applications. There are lots of challenges to address here. One of the most important are losses. But the physics is so much fun, and we have lots of exciting time working on this. And that brings me to the final conclusion for this presentation. The take-home message here is that nanophotonics is the way to process information which is unsurpassed, because photons is the fastest way to send information. And since we would like to have our devices on nanoscale, we want to couple light to nanostructures. To resolve this fundamental problem of mismatch between the wavelengths of light, which is on the scale of half a micron, and size, typical size of nanostructures, let's say 10 nanometers and smaller, you need efficient couplers. And those couplers can be made based on what we call plasmonic nanostructures, which act as optical nano-antennas, efficiently coupling light to nanostructures and guiding them on photonic integrated circuits. So this is a very promising way to manipulate light and to develop nanophotonic devices based on that. There is yet another application of critical importance, which is sensing, which can be done with the same type of structures, with the same type of optical nano-antennas, by using the same fact that they accumulate extremely large fields on nanoscale. You can actually sense very minute quantities of biologically important molecules down to actually single molecules. And there is very exciting physics closely associated with this structure, such as the one which relates to materials with negative refractive index, so-called metamaterials. Those materials could revolutionize the optical technology and bring lots of new exciting applications. I thank you for your attention.